Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagha Maradian, and hope everybody had a very Merry Christmas and a very happy Kwanzaa. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us, as they do every week for our roundtable, are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy here in Washington, D.C. as well. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us and hope you all had a very, very good holiday.
Yeah, thanks, Vagha. It's great to be here again.
Thank you very much indeed, Vagha. Great to be here and happy Christmas to everyone.
Yeah, all the best for Christmas and the holidays and in the new year. And thanks for having this take place as usual.
It's an absolute pleasure. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Okay, guys, the charge today is to look back at what has been truly an unprecedented year, 2020, shaped by the coronavirus pandemic that, as we tape, has claimed the lives of more than 32,000 Americans, and I think sort of 1.7 million around the world. And aside from the pandemic, the two other major stories that we were focused on at the end of last year were, or three stories, were 737, MAX grounding, how Brexit was going to turn out, and also what Asian air travel numbers were going to be. Before we get started on sort of the highlights of the year, the good stories, the bad stories, the good and bad stories that should have gotten more coverage that they didn't, as well as those who deserve laurels or darts at the end of the year. Sash, biggest news of the week clearly was the Brexit deal that was struck on Christmas Eve, if I'm not mistaken. Talk to us about your perspective on where the deal ended up.
I think most people remotely involved in Brexit, which means almost anybody who's been thinking about it in the UK and those people who've had to think about it in Europe, is just feeling a sense of exhaustion and relief, or senses of exhaustion and relief. But net, you know, the UK and the European Union achieved a deal at the very, very last minute. The negotiation was incredibly tough. I mean, shockingly tough. You don't negotiate with friends, or at least if you're negotiating with friends, you end up not being friends, which is very, very sad. But I think that from where we are now, I think that the UK government achieved a better deal than almost anybody would have expected even a month ago, let alone 6 months ago, 9 months ago. You know, it was, as we joked earlier on in this, you know, in previous podcasts, it was thanks for all the fish. The trade-off was fish versus cars versus, you know, relatively free access to the European market. And ultimately, it shows the fish have a value far above how much it costs to buy the stuff at a market, because the UK threat of you know, cutting off European access to UK fisheries achieved results that were you know, surprisingly effective. It's a great shame we had to come, you know, had to get to this stage, but as it is, you know, the relationship between the UK and Europe in terms of trading will be relatively soft as we go into 2021. The key network industries in our case aerospace, but also, you know, automobiles and so forth, defense, are going to be very unaffected as a consequence of that. And that's terribly good news, frankly. Now we can settle down to you know, all the respective European nations to looking at actually how to get the economies to recover from coronavirus once the process of vaccinations has taken place. And that is clearly going to be the story for to start 2021.
But the financial sector still isn't covered by this. And that's one of the great engines of the British economy, no matter how much people want to put fish, right? I mean, it was the fish ultimately, whether for the Johnson administration or for French or the French or the Dutch, right? And the Danes. Fishing became something important where concessions were worth doing, because it is a constituency that is this sort of historical, cultural, and so all governments are willing to go to some lengths in order to be able to protect them. But at the end of the day, the question that's far, far more important to the British economy is the finance industry. how's the finance industry going to fare at the end of this with this deal?
Finance industry is going to have to do what it's done since the 1960s with the creation of the Eurobond industry and compete its way going forward. Yeah, you're absolutely right. The deal as signed as announced on Christmas Eve doesn't include a lot for the finance industry. Frankly, it was never going to. The issue of what's been referred to as passporting, which would be the ability of the City of London to carry out all of its actions and activities free of constraint in Europe, that was never going to be agreed by the European Union. I think that's going to be one of the issues that we're going to see evolving through a series of probably very, very small agreements through 21, 22, 23. But it's important to remember that although there has been a single market in goods in Europe for the last 25 plus years, the idea that there's been a single market for financial services has been a theory, it's been a dream, but it really hasn't applied in practice. It's been very, very hard for some industries to actually, or some parts of the financial services industry, to sell into Europe and vice versa. So, it's not perfect for the financial services industry, but I think that was less important in terms of jobs, and particularly the jobs that are most economically sensitive, than sorting out network industries, manufacturing, cars, aerospace. And in terms of where the votes are and where the votes for Brexit were and where the votes against the incumbent politicians in Europe would be in 21, 22, that was fishing. That was the very impoverished towns and cities facing the North Sea. That's why this was what the deal focused on.
It very much is sort of like Hitchhiker's Guide, right? As we've been saying on the show, so long and thanks for all the fish. So that brings that chapter, fortunately, to a close, or not, right? It's the end of the beginning, I suppose. Ron, give us your take on sort of highlights of the year. What stories you thought good or bad that deserved more attention, or just the stuff in general about how the year played out?
Well, I think an interesting starting point is what were we saying going into the year, right? Before Corona kind of broke loose, if you will, we were looking for air traffic in 2020 to be like, how do I say, low mid single digit, decelerating year over year. I think Richard will talk about this probably later about air traffic in Asia slowing down, particularly in China. But it was, year over year, we're still going to have air traffic growth, but decelerating air traffic growth, a decelerating market for wide body aircraft. That was an expectation coming into the year. I would say coming into the year, there was probably an expectation that there was a good chance that the Trump administration would get reelected. So, what does that all mean for defense spending and so on and so forth? That's the point of that point. And because of Corona, everything got turned on its head, right? And we can talk a bit about that. I think things that jumped out to me this year that were maybe buried under the Corona haze, if you will, I think there's a couple interesting things. On the technology front, Aerotech and Magnus flew a Cessna 208B Grand Caravan. They flew that with an all-electric propulsion system. So I think on the propulsion front, we saw steps forward. On the hydrogen front, ZeroAvia flew an aircraft in Cranfield. That was a Piper Malibu that had a fuel cell-powered Malibu. So, it's a hydrogen-powered aircraft. So I think on propulsion, and lest me forget the goal that Airbus put out there, I think it was about 2035, to have hydrogen-powered aircraft in service. So I think alternative propulsion got pushed forward this year, and that probably didn't get as much coverage as maybe it should have because of Corona. So that's one that jumps out to me. Two, when you think about commercial space, we had a big year on several fronts. Virgin Galactic late in 2019 went public through a SPAC. It was one of the first space backs. Now we're seeing several of them kind of follow on after that. And, you know, they had an action-packed year. And, you know, the equity actually did quite well this year. And then on the heels of that, you've got things like Momentus Space and some other things coming. And then you had the, you know, the Crew Dragon 2 was the Crew Dragon 2 with SpaceX. So I think it was a big year in space on multiple fronts that, again, maybe didn't get the coverage it should have because of, you know, what was going on with Corona. And then on 737, I think the thinking was coming into the year, we might see the aircraft into service mid-year, early Q3. That's what Boeing was saying right now. That didn't happen. So we're seeing the aircraft go back into service, you know, very, very late in the year. So I think those are the three, you know, 3 points that really jump out to me, given, you know, what happened and where we are.
I'm glad you mentioned the Crew Dragon 2 because it was a little bit reminiscent. I mean, not quite Apollo 8 in 1968, which was at the end of just a terrible year, this incredible accomplishment of flying man to the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. I mean, not landing, but still, I mean, was one of the most incredible voyages in human history, right? The accelerated into service of the Saturn V. Nobody had ever ridden it before. Nobody had tested the deep space tracking network, right? I mean, that flight was supposed to be a high Earth orbit flight and instead became a lunar flight. So, I mean, I'm not saying the Crew Dragon 2 was anything near that level of accomplishment, but it was still a welcome American return to space with, you know, an all new spacecraft, touched screens, new spacesuits. I mean, it was sort of a real impressive accomplishment. And then putting four astronauts into space successfully just a couple of months later was something that certainly was an uplifting story in the year. Richard, why don't you give us your sense on the year? You know, Ron just mentioned about air traffic figures, and I remember that, you know, you were the among the first to be speculating like something is going on in China that's driving a decline in some of these passenger numbers. You know, give us your sense on the year and what you thought some of the high points and low points were.
Yeah, you know, unquestionably, China was, I think, the biggest single theme of the year. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, you know, other than the pandemic, yeah. You know, we went into this year with like a significant sea change in air travel, largely but not completely attributable to China. You know, your typical year is 5.5% increase in revenue passenger kilometers. It's been that way for a decade, but 2017 was 7.6, 2018, 6.5, way above trend, really nice. And then we go into 2019 and we only had 4.2. And that was the lowest it had been for quite a few years. And so much of that was China. And China went from 12.2 in late 2018 to just 5.3 in late 2019. And if you're moved by numbers, and I guess I, you know, occasionally am, strangely enough, it was notable because, you know, revenue passenger kilometers are a function of GDP. And with a fast growth emerging market like China, it's typically a 2x multiplier. And their 2018 GDP grew by 6.1%, which means 12.2% was perfect in line. The numbers were all matching up. That is a wonderful thing. And then 5.3, which means only one of two things. One, they were lying about their GDP in 2019, or something broke in the multiplier about, you know, the market. Basically, it wasn't doing the usual 2x. And obviously, we're not going to learn what happened this year, because of course it's all washed away by this terrible pandemic news, but it still was a noteworthy event. We're going to have to see, as you know, good news, China has recovered somewhat more than anybody else. That's for sure. Will they resume at double-digit growth that we'd seen in years before? Or will they resume growth at an anemic pace? That's going to be the interesting thing to watch. The other things I would pay attention to, of course, you know, decoupling was the big theme, macroeconomic and in terms of the industry in 2020 between China and the West, especially the U.S. Can the Biden administration reverse that somehow? I don't know. It's going to be a tough one. But that's going to be an interesting thing to watch. Other big themes, I would slightly, you know, Ron is, of course, correct. Big steps forward in alternative propulsion. I would argue we made big steps forward in greenwashing in the face of what we saw in 2019. with all that concern about, well, you know, do you have to travel, et cetera, you know, the entire ecological footprint. Because the idea of a hydrogen-powered plane in the mid-2030s is, well, you know, I mean, if it'll help us reach cloud cuckoo land, so much the better, but not reality, no. And then finally, I guess the third thing I would choose as being significant is, you know, the significant advance in manned unmanned teaming as a concept, whether it's Boeing's Air Power Australia, you know, Royal Wingman, or of course Skyborg, the contract awards, particularly to Kratos, really a newcomer in the airframing space. That was a significant step forward. And I think a step in a direction of a rather new air power philosophy.
I want to say that I believe Blaugas can make a comeback, obviously powered Zeppelin. So why can't it? No, I'm just kidding. Sash, give us your sense on the year. And Ron, I'm going to get to you in just a second because I think you want to add a couple of points. Go ahead, Sash.
Yeah, I was first of all just going to pick up on the issue of hydrogen. And you know, this is a subject that I think I'm genuinely agnostic about. But I think that what is so fascinating about the Airbus target for a 2035 entry into service, whether it's an entry into service or actually first flight, frankly, I'd expect it's more likely the latter, of a hydrogen-powered airplane, is that that is only an Airbus target because the French government has said we'll put up to 15 billion euros to make that possible. This is actually part of the French government's coronavirus recovery plan, is to stimulate a completely new civil aerospace propulsion industry. And I think this has massive implications for the balance of power between Europe and the US and for the balance of power between current partners. You know, effectively, this money is going to be out there to help Airbus develop some form of hydrogen propelled or many forms of hydrogen powered aircraft at a time when Boeing is crippled by the actions of its previous management in giving away the cash that they need now to back to shareholders and generally wasting it and then getting it, you know, preoccupied with the 737 MAX problem, which was a problem of their own making. And this is, you know, the French government COVID recovery cash is effectively paying for Safran, among other people, to break out from the clutches of, or, you know, from the partnership with General Electric and probably become, you know, the European leader in next generation aero engines. So, you know, even if it's not entry in service, but it's first flight by 2035, where's the cash for that sort of visionary development going to come from in the States?
It's a very, very important question at the end of the day. The problem it poses for Boeing is you have a major manufacturer that's looking to that cleaner energy airplane that takes the industry to the next step, while Boeing is still trying to figure out what it wants to do, and then doubtless increases the pressure on Boeing that whatever it does will try to achieve some of those goals as well, ultimately, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ron?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Sash? Or Richard? Ron, why don't you take us, because you had a point you wanted to make as well.
Well, I think the next point kind of folds into that question is ultimately, there was a lot of discussion this year over Airbus doing better than Boeing, particularly in the narrow body market, right? We talked a lot about that. But I think areas we didn't talk about and, you know, caused by similar circumstances, I mean, the pandemic, right, is, you know, the great amplifier, and those who were strong came out stronger and those who were weak came out weaker. And I think two places where that really, I think there wasn't a lot of talk about is one, if you look at Embraer, the Embraer situation really got in the shadow of the Boeing deal breaking, but more importantly, they're the only one left standing in that market. Now, granted, you know, the regional jet market is a smaller market than their bigger sister aircraft, but it's certainly a big enough market for one player, and they're it. So, you know, they're going to exit the year, enter next year. But I think, you know, if you look at what happened in this past year, they're going to exit the year as the only manufacturer in the regional jet market left with a decent product, you know, on top of that, right? So it's I think that's one point. And then the other point is if you look at how well Gulfstream did, and I think I mentioned this before, but I think, you know, I'll just kind of reiterate at this point. Gulfstream's deliveries year over year hung in there pretty well. Their operating performance was, you know, short of, you know, stellar. They made money, real money. They generated cash. Right. They were, you know, not only the most profitable airplane company in the world, I think the only profitable airplane company in the world by, you know, 100 miles. And I don't think that's gotten much discussion, that, you know, how strong a franchise that is and how much stronger it is coming out of the pandemic.
Because at the end of the day, if you have money and you want to travel, whether you're doing it on a fractional or whether you're doing an outright purchase for your business, right? At the end of the day, you still have to travel. You still have to meet people.
Yeah, exactly.
It's good business.
Yeah.
Let's shift. Sash and Richard, do you guys have anything to add to this? Because I do want to spend a little bit of time on what we thought were defense needle movers, because it has been an interesting year for defense around the world in terms of added budgets, new investment programs, and new programs. But I just wanted to get your sense closing out on commercial before we move on to defense.
I guess it's just one more data point of a year in terms of asserting the very high barriers to entry in this industry. It's a big thing for, you know, we've been waiting for 12, 15, however many years for Mitsubishi to enter the market. Big deal for them to effectively leave it and to, you know, almost carnivorously take down the last Bombardier commercial aero in the process. This is an industry that favors only the big players. As Ron said, the big trend of this year was to accelerate that trend and reassert the existing producers as pretty much the only ones that matter.
The interesting thing is that that's the case in almost every single market, whether it's in high-end wristwatches, right? You need somebody who can make the massive investment to make some, you know, watches. It's the same thing for commercial aircraft. It's the same for defense products, right? Which is what's been driving consolidation. So it's really, really interesting to see what happens when you have this duopoly with a number of other players and where they'll go, right? So Bombardier has been taken off the table. Embraer is still there. Comac wants to do it. At some point, right, that's a potential deal right there that could be something interesting that I think we've talked about as well. On the defense side, what were, Sash, the interesting stories from your perspective on defense? You know, for me, among the highlights were obviously the one-year prototyping effort on NGAD, the next generation air dominance aircraft for the U.S. Air Force that was impressive. If it is what it is that we think that it is impressive, even if we were using piece parts from other programs. I also thought the September 3 test was extraordinary, to use Army self-propelled howitzers shooting hypersonic projectiles to shoot down cruise missiles. That's the kind of innovation that I think is going to be absolutely necessary. But we saw, whether it was on Tempest and SCAF are ongoing and maybe got boosts. Talk to us about what you thought some of the interesting defense stories of the year were.
No, I think the remarkable thing about the British Defense Review is that having expected cuts, the politics and the politics on so many levels, UK's relationship with the US, UK's relationship with Europe, the UK's historic underfunding of defense meant that the only solution was to spend more. And it is pretty remarkable at a time when every nation's finances are being damaged badly by coronavirus, certainly here in Europe and the US, the solution to a defense review was, we'll spend more money. We'll spend another $16 billion. We'll increase the equipment budget probably by 15-20% or so. There will be some very, very difficult decisions to be made coming forward. But no, it was a remarkable outcome for defense. I mean, what I'd like to just highlight, because you're absolutely right, it's been really difficult to talk about defense this year, because we have been quite rightly very focused on the civil aerospace recession of hopefully our lifetimes. We'd rather it had not occurred in our lifetimes, caused by coronavirus. But the big story in European defense, and I make no apologies for being parochial at this stage, has been that European countries have kept on spending. And when in doubt, as with the UK, they have spent more than was expected. So, you know, we've talked about the UK, but look at the Swedish defense budget that came out just before Christmas. Much more money than expected. They're going to buy more submarines. They're going to buy more combat aircraft. They are raising, you know, they're actually raising more troops, which is not the sort of thing that happens in European democracies very often. But they've decided that is the solution to their problems. Look at Hungary, which is a, you know, at best, mid-sized Central European country. It's a small mid-sized Central European country. And it spent this year buying air defense missiles, armored vehicles, self-propelled artillery, and turning itself from being a, you know, armed forces with former Soviet cast-offs to having a, you know, Western equipment on order that any nation in NATO would be jealous of. You know, those are really interesting examples of how the even in a time of coronavirus, European defense spending has kept on going up, and at the margin more than expected.
And also worth pointing out, right, that not only was there that 40% increase in defense spending over the multi-year plan, but also a vote on considering NATO, which was also another very, very powerful message, especially exceptional coming from Swedes that have always guarded the country's well, that's not fair because it is an EU country and abides by all the rules of mutual defense by that go into an EU nation.
Yeah, so but I mean, you're absolutely right. Neutrality just ain't what it used to be in Europe anymore. I mean, the only truly neutral nation in Europe is Switzerland. Sweden and Finland, and Finland was neutral because of the agreement done between the US and Russia. And Sweden, you know, because of their own very, very clearly expressed choices for the whole of the post-war period, those two nations are now NATO-leaning and, you know, NATO-focused in a way that I couldn't have conceived of 5 years ago.
Richard, your take on from a defense standpoint about what you thought were the top stories?
Well, as you mentioned before, NGAD, that was certainly interesting. Whether or not it means anything to fight a prototype, you know, relative to missionizing a prototype, I think is pretty important. As I said before, of course, the, you know, the big step forward was in air power teaming and the realization that in order to have the kind of effectiveness that we're going to need in a future confrontation with a peer adversary, which of course means, well, China, there's, you know, going to need to be an adaptation of remote, you know, loyal wingmen or what have you. And that's really interesting. B-21 seems to be on course. If something bad were to happen in terms of program timetable, I think it would have come out this year, and it doesn't seem to have. It sounds like we're going pretty well. Getting KC-46 more or less on track, or at least the horrible news amplitudes have slowed a bit. I mean, it's hard to tell exactly what you'd call good news. F-35, I guess the UAE deal, that not only added 50, assuming it's 50 F-35s to the order book, but it also made lives difficult for people in the business of selling fourth-generation fighters, be it Eurofighter Rafale or F-15s or what have you. That was an interesting development, especially if it's going to be followed by other countries, particularly Saudi Arabia. They're big question marks, but basically it really was a game change for the all-important Middle Eastern fighter market. I think that was, you know, very important. The only thing I would add to all of this, of course, is the continued ratcheting up of tensions in East Asia. And I wouldn't call it an arms race, but let's just say continued robust defense spending in all of the countries around China as a response to the perception of the threat.
Yeah, I would, maybe I'll start with a point that kind of jumps off of Richard's last point. I think one of the big things, big takeaways in, you know, the last year was really the further push on the, what do you want to call it, the tech, high tech decoupling with China, or potential decoupling with China, particularly on issues of communication systems, 5G, sensitivity around microprocessor fabrication, the push to have Taiwan Semi build a facility in the Southwest in the U.S. I mean, I think that was a big dynamic in the previous year that shouldn't be lost on the defense community. To the big push on the Navy, right? We've seen that for a while, but you had the previous Secretary of Defense, his outlook for the Navy, and given the force projection required into the Pacific region of the world, it doesn't seem like the accelerators are going to come off the Navy in any material way with the next administration. So, I think the Navy was a big shining point in the previous year. And then maybe finally, high speed. And, I think the cap there at the end of the year, Lockheed's potential acquisition of Aerojet Rocketdyne, suggests a real focus on hypersonics, but in other ways too, right? I mean, you had the United States Air Force Works Division, if you want to call it that, funding Boom Supersonic, Exosonic, Hermes, the Ariane team is, I would say more than inching closer. I mean, really moving a lot closer to bringing a reality to a supersonic business jet that, of course, could have defense applications. So I think those are the three areas that jump out.
And that was the AFWERX, the Air Force's, accelerator has been interested in that and a whole bunch of other technologies, which are going to be very important for the future. Let's wrap this up with people who deserve kudos and anybody who deserves darts over the course of the year that go beyond something simplistic like major political leaders, for example, whether it's Donald Trump or Joe Biden. Sash, why don't you start us off? Because I think you've got two laurels on the European side of things.
Yeah, I'll start with a pretty straightforward one. But I mean, I think Guillaume Faury, the chief executive of Airbus, deserves kudos for recognizing that coronavirus was an existential threat to the civil aerospace industry and for cutting production deep and early. It's something that doesn't happen very often in this industry. Typically, production lags reality. Certainly on the downside, quite badly, sometimes by 2 or 3 years in this industry. And Airbus cut production within 6 weeks of, or announced the production cuts within 6 weeks of, the enormity of coronavirus taking effect. That's pretty conventional, but I still think, that was, that took us by surprise that they were able to do that. They felt both, they were realistic about the problems, but also they were confident enough about Airbus's position to do something that nobody's ever done that before. The other person that I think deserves credit is the French Foreign Minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, previously the French Defense Minister, who throughout his career in at senior levels of French government, whatever his title, has really been the Minister for Rafale. And Jean-Yves Le Drian's reputation is of a man who can consume prodigious amounts of tea and coffee in meetings without needing a break, and whose ability to do that and to charm and impress his hosts wherever he has been selling Rafale, as well as, France in its broader sense, is, really, really impressive. And, if you just look at the scorecard at the moment, we're ending 2020 with Rafale either ordered or on the very, very short list for Greece, Croatia, possibly the UAE, Indonesia, possibly Switzerland. Rafale has never ended a year with as good a list of potential export customers. They should probably win three of those, might even win four. I didn't even mention Finland because I think Rafale is behind there. Jean-Yves Le Drian and his astonishing ability to drink tea and coffee, I think deserves a lot of kudos. And he doesn't really get the recognition he deserves there.
He's extraordinary for his candor, his ability to get people focused and to kind of win them over in his sort of non-splashy sort of down to earth way, which I think he deserves enormous credit for, frankly. But I know exactly what you mean. I'm not trying to take away from that. But he is a very, very impressive guy, and perhaps one of the most underrated. So that was a great pick on your part, Sash. Richard?
Completely agree. As a matter of fact, I'd extend it to pretty much all of French aerospace leadership. You know, there's this wonderfully named Israeli political party that translates as there is a future, you know, like a little reminder, there is a future. And I think the French fully embraced that. They said, we're going to power through this. And, you know, the French across the board said that. Do I believe in hydrogen by 2035? Of course I don't, being a rational human being here. But nevertheless, the idea of saying, let's keep the engineers employed, let's keep companies going, let's make sure the manufacturing base stays intact, and let's make sure we keep exporting stuff, just like Sash said about the Rafale. It was more than just Rafale, though. It was everything. Whereas in the U.S., they would probably need that little there is a future reminder. There's still no meaningful aid package aside from keeping airline workers employed, which is hardly strategic. It may be useful, it may be desirable, but it is not the same as saying, hey, there's a future, let's go for it. And most of all, Boeing leadership, their idea of the future is returning to, playing with financial abstractions rather than actually developing new product as a response to accelerating market needs. And as a result, they look at the future in terms of market share loss and say, well, but we can still play with financial abstractions, right? Okay, that's good. That's a future, sort of. And to me, the contrast couldn't be any more glaring. So all of France pitted against all of the US. And I got to say, I'm looking at Team France pretty enviously.
And just before we go to Ron, because Ron, I think you've got a kudo candidate. Just want to say, you know, as I mentioned on the Washington Roundtable, that the Pentagon leadership, especially under Mark Esper, I think does deserve some credit for keeping the department as clean running as possible under the circumstances, with what has been, I think, a very, very competent team, whether you include in that Dave Norquist, the Deputy Secretary, Alan Lord on Acquisition and Sustainment, Mark Lewis, as well as a number of other, the service secretaries as well, having done a pretty stable job overall. Ron, go to you on the last one.
Yeah, so the one I'd like to highlight would be Gwen Shotwell, right? You know, Gwen is the COO of and president of SpaceX. And I think when everybody talks about SpaceX, they always end up talking about Elon. And she runs the day-to-day there, right? So you have to give her a lot of credit for what happened this year with the Crew Dragon 2 and all the advancements there. And probably one of the most exciting stories in aerospace today is SpaceX and everything they've done. And you have to give her a lot of credit for that. So, my kudo for the year would be to Gwen and everything and her leadership at SpaceX.
Yeah, and you can't laugh at, while everything has been happening on the Falcon side of things, obviously the company has also been working Starship, which has also been getting a lot of attention, despite a failure, right? They achieved almost all of their test points on that test. So that was pretty impressive. And just before we part, I just wanted to see whether or not anybody wants to shoot any darts at anybody. Ron, I know that for compliance reasons, you're waived from that. But I think that before we started this, you guys were saying that on this extraordinary year, we may want to pass on darts. Or I think as Richard, that you had a clever way of putting it.
Yeah, I think it's just pumping shotgun shells into dead livestock, because it just seems like such a brutal year that you can give people a pass and maybe hope they make better decisions next year when the market environment is a little bit better.
As you so artfully put it, right? Anybody who, the people who deserve darts know who they are. Go ahead, Sash, for the last thought of the year.
Yeah, I think we've had 51 weeks where we've made very clear where we think people have been, certain people have been doing things wrong. This is what passes for the season of goodwill. I'm happy to leave it there.
And on that note is a good a place as any to end this, guys. I hope you have a very, very happy new year, and the same to our audience. Thanks so much for joining us over the past 12 months, already looking together to work together with you guys next year, and wishing everybody a happy, healthy, and prosperous 2021. Glad to be seeing the back of 2020 for sure. Thanks so very much again, and happy new year to all.
Yeah, Vago, thank you. Thank you very much. And always a pleasure to be here, and happy holidays to everybody.
Yeah, Vago, thank you for another very, very interesting year, but I'm really hoping 2021's a lot better. Happy New Year to you all.
Thanks so much, Vago. Let's hope for fewer dumpster and tire fires this year, and a great one to all.
Absolutely. And we're going to, for our audience, just an audience note, we'll be back again next week for our look ahead to what we think the big stories of 2021 will be. Thanks very much again to all.